It's Amelia's weekly fish fry. Hey, did you miss me? Because I missed you, every single one of you. If you didn't know already, I'm your electronic engineering podcasting hostess, Amelia Dalton, from eejournal.com. And this week, I have a very special guest. You may know him as the editor-in-chief of EE Journal. You may also know him as an expert in the world of field-programmable Gatorades. Or heck, you may even know him as one of the co-authors of the world-famous travel blog called Riveted. Well, I managed to get him on Fish Fry. Now, if you knew how few times I actually see him, you know, in person, even though we live in the same city and work for the same company, yeah, it wasn't easy. Yep, I'm talking about Kevin Morris. And Kevin is here to talk about his Fortran days, the 50th anniversary of Moore's Law coming up, and what it means to electronic design today, the learning curve of FPGA design, and even a little bit about why his favorite project of all time was, well, I don't want to give it all away. Let's get started. Hi, Kevin. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Amelia. Glad to be here. A little frightened, but that's just from what I've heard about this show.
Don't be. I don't bite. So first off, tell my audience how you got started in EE. Now, as I remember, your first job in electronic engineering was at a gate array place and route company. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Right after I got my degree in electrical engineering, I went to work for a startup company in Austin, Texas. And we did place and route software for gate arrays. This was in the early 1980s. So our big challenge at the time was to place and route a gate array that had 10,000 gates. And for us, that was a huge problem. We were trying to get that to route on a VAX 11780 at the time. And it would take about 24 hours to do one run of a 10,000 gate array for place and route on a VAX 11780. Interestingly, at the time, we had a startup company with about 60 people in it.
Okay.
We didn't even have our own computer.
What? Really?
Yeah. We were in Austin, Texas, and our computer was located in Silicon Valley. We were renting computer time from a company that had the computer.
The computer,
right. And we would all do our Fortran coding. This, as I mentioned, was about a million lines of Fortran. We would all do our Fortran coding on these little sheets that had a block for each character, and it was like filling out your driver's license application. And then there was somebody that had a TI Silent 700 terminal with one of those old phone modems that they would clip up, and they would key punch the code that we would write using the Silent 700 terminal, and that would go over the phone lines out to Silicon Valley. And then here's the fun part. In Silicon Valley, they would run that through, and they would get the batch big printout paper from whatever test we were running, and then they would FedEx that back to us. So we would enter code today, and then if we did everything right, the next day we would get back the results of that computer run that had our new code in it. So the cycle time was pretty pathetic by today's standards.
Yeah.
That company was later bought out by Tektronix, and then Tektronix was getting into the electronic design automation business in those days. So I sort of went through with that merger. I ended up going to several companies through that, and I was in the EDA business for about the next 20 or 25 years.
What ended up being your specialty in EDA in particular?
I did a lot of things in EDA. One of the things was synthesis. I specialized for a long time in high-level synthesis, like behavioral synthesis, or today they call it HLS, where you synthesize from C or C++ code into hardware that can be implemented using regular RTL synthesis techniques. I spent quite a bit of time in FPGA synthesis, and that's really how I kind of got interested in FPGAs, was managing a team that was doing synthesis software for FPGAs.
Gotcha. All right. So with all your history in EE, let's talk about the future. Now, where do you see 2015 headed? Where do you think electronic design is headed in 2015? And try to answer that question in less than 10 minutes, if you can.
Less than 10 minutes. That's a challenge. I think 2015 is a really interesting year. we're at a pretty amazing milestone. 2015 in April will be the 50th anniversary of a paper that Gordon Moore wrote in 1965, I believe. And that paper was published in Electronics Magazine, and it was called Cramming More Components onto Integrated Circuits. And in that paper, he makes the prediction that later became known as Moore's Law, that every 2 years we would have twice as many transistors that we could put on a chip, and that he could see that trend going on for at least the next 10 years, he said. And so now we're going to have been going on that trend for 50 years. For half a century, we will have doubled the number of transistors we could put on a chip every 2 years. That's a pretty amazing milestone.
It is.
One of the things I expect is going to happen, and I don't think it will be a hard date like in 2015, but I think one of the things we're seeing happening right now is I believe Moore's Law is coming to an end.
Really?
Yes. And I know I'm not the first person to predict this. In fact, I was mentioning having a job back in the early 1980s. And in about 1984, I sat in a presentation by a gentleman that was a fellow at IBM Labs. He
okay.
was a PhD physicist and an expert in semiconductors. And the main theme of his talk was that 1 micron would be it. That the 1 micron designs that we were starting on in 1985... that was cool. This Moore's Law thing has been fun, but that was the end of the line. And he said the reason was physics, that because of physics, there was no way anybody would be able to make devices with features smaller than 1 micron. So here we are 40 years later,
right?
Or 30 years after that prediction, we're down to 14 nanometer. We're talking about 10 nanometer and even 7 nanometer designs. So we are far, far beyond when the experts in the day and 1984, we're going to call an end to Moore's Law. So it might be a little bold of me to call an end to Moore's Law right now, but I see a lot of factors driving that. First, yes, the technology keeps getting harder and harder. The things we have to do today to make, say, 14 nanometer designs and beyond are incredible. All the things like double patterning and the amount of trouble that we will go to make this happen is just pretty astounding.
Right.
If we want to go beyond that, at some point we're probably going to have to go to EUV.
Mm-hmm.
And to make EUV work, just a quick anecdote, they have a mist of 10 droplets that are suspended, and these microscopic droplets have to be hit individually, targeted with a laser. This is a laser that's like the size of a boxcar. And in the process of doing that, the microscopic 10 droplet is deformed into a kind of a lens, and it vaporizes somewhat, and it gives off photons. And then another device has to collect those photons and push them down for your light source. I mean, this is insanely difficult to do.
Yes.
And if you pull all that stuff off, then you've built a light bulb. Like this is
right.
This is just the light bulb for doing the exposure of the mask. There are so many other things beyond that. So technology-wise, it's incredibly difficult what we're going to have to do for these next few nodes. But it seems like engineers can always find a way.
Mm-hmm.
Every time we say that's technologically impossible, you know, going back to my 1984 anecdote, engineers have proved us wrong.
True.
And I believe that you can give engineers just about any challenge, and with enough time, they will find a solution. Engineers are an amazing bunch. But I think the big problem is going to be money.
Mm.
And money is a lot less forgiving than technology is, it turns out.
True.
The cost of these new fabs is going up, doubling just about every process node. And there comes a point where it's not worth the extra cost for the incremental benefit you get.
Right.
And I think we're in an amazing stage right now where Moore's Law has brought us far enough for a lot of spectacular applications. And yes, if Moore's Law kept going, we could do some incremental things that we can't do today.
Mm-hmm.
But today, so much of the new technology is software that if we have the platforms that can run the software, then to me, the big advances that are going to be made and that need to be made to deliver new capabilities are more in software than they are in just pushing the Moore's Law curve along further.
Sure.
And I expect to see some spectacular things happen there. I think the combination of things like IoT, wearable devices, the mobile internet. I wrote yesterday an article about self-driving cars. Things like that take an aggregation of a very large number of technologies along with the incredible computing power that Moore's Law has brought, and bring all those things to bear in order to make one amazing thing happen, like a car that can drive itself.
Right.
Quadcopters that can fly autonomously and safely and stable. All of the things in wearables and sensors that are going on, all of those things are really not just one technology, but this aggregation of lots of different technologies.
So let's talk about those self-driving cars, and in particular, FPGAs. Now,
one of my favorite topics.
Right, and you're a bit of an expert. Okay, so where do you see FPGA design in particular headed in the coming months or years even? Do you think the learning curve for FPGA designs is getting easier over time?
It most definitely is, and I believe that the learning curve for learning to do FPGA design is actually the biggest barrier to adoption for FPGAs spreading into new technology areas. FPGAs are an example of the kind of thing I talked about where now we have technology that's good enough for a lot of applications.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be that kind of only the highest end FPGAs were interesting. Everybody wanted the biggest, fastest device that the FPGA companies could make.
Right.
And today, the FPGA companies have FPGAs that span an enormous range. There are tiny little devices with a couple of thousand LUTs that are 2 millimeters square and cost less than a dollar. And there are giant devices with 4 million LUTs that, you know, are almost the size of a credit card, and they cost a 4 or 5 digit amount of money. So, you know, we've got a 10,000x difference in the price of FPGAs and a similar difference in the size.
Right.
And all of those different sizes are being used. But FPGAs take a lot of expertise to program today. And one of the things that the companies have been focusing on a lot is developing software tools that make it easier to do FPGA design.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to not require you to be an expert in VHDL or Verilog and in RTL synthesis and in place and route and in timing closure in order to do FPGA design if they're going to go out to this next wave of adopters for FPGAs. We need to see more methods like high-level languages.
Mm-hmm.
C, C++, OpenCL is taking off in a pretty big way for FPGA design. Model-based design, where you're kind of plugging together things, but without having to develop any of the low-level HDL yourself. And I think that we need to see those methods get robust and sophisticated enough that an average software designer that doesn't have a hardware design background can still successfully program and use an FPGA. When we pass that milestone where that's a reliable, robust technology, I think the use of FPGAs is going to explode.
Okay, are you ready for your off-the-cuff question?
I was hoping I'd talked long enough on the last ones, there was no time. Yes, I'm ready for my off-the-cuff question.
All right, so you've been in this industry for some long amount of time. What is your most favorite project?
My favorite project professionally was probably working on high-level synthesis. In the early to mid-90s, we were some of the first people doing a high-level synthesis project. Had the opportunity to go all over the world and interview people that were working at different startups and different research organizations and universities and kind of find the people in the world who were the best experts in what we called at the time behavioral synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
Hired several of them, brought them together, started a team, and that was really exciting because we were developing a brand new capability. There was a lot of energy in the team because we felt like this is the technology of the future. At the time, we said, okay, in 4 or 5 years, this is the way everyone is going to do design. It's all going to be high-level synthesis.
Right.
That 4 or 5 years remained the next 4 or 5 years for the next 2 decades. And just now, it's starting to actually roll into a broad production use. But I would have to say that was my most fun project that I had the most personal energy in.
Excellent. Well, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me on Fish Fry, Kevin.
Well, thank you for having me, Amelia. And maybe I'll come back when we have some of these predictions and see if they're true or not.
Now, if you want to read Kevin's most recent article about how Altera FPGAs helped Audi get a car from San Francisco to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this week without a driver. Yeah, cool stuff. Go ahead and click the link below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com, and it will take you right there. But what if this week's Fish Frying crystal ball just isn't enough? You're just dying for more electronic engineering divination. Then I highly suggest that you read Jim Turley's feature article this week on eejournal.com entitled New Year's Resolution, 1024 by 768, Hazy Predictions for the Coming Year in Technology. Jim reveals his predictions for the coming year that include Intel will make Apple's processor chips, Google will acquire some startup you've never heard of, and the United States Congress will fail to rationalize patent and copyright law. Seriously, if this article doesn't at least make you chuckle, you might want to check that pulse of yours. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And hey, if Google Plus is your thing, yes, you can join our circle on Google Plus as well. We also have a YouTube channel, keyword EE Journal, that is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, our very own popular Chalk Talk webcast series, and our video series called On the Scene. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Fryin' page, you can also grab our Fish Fryin' RSS feed or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Fryin' page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or the best geeky hotspot in your hometown, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of January 9th, 2015, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.